Hello there, and welcome to the Comic Book Tesseract, the only comics netcast that's bigger on the inside than it is on the outside. I'm Justin Chalupka. Every week, we review and preview the world of comics, along with other facets of geek chic culture. We're going to have a fun show this week. We got actually kind of a light week. We missing a lot of the DC titles. They had a skip week, since this is a five-week month. And Jason and I, being the DC fanboys that we are, had short stacks. But that being said, there were still some good books this week that we definitely want to hit on. A couple stinkers as well. We'll hit on those too. Anyways, Jason, how are you doing this week, man?
I am doing well this week. And while there weren't as many DC books out because they want to keep their numbering up with the new 52, it gave me a chance to pick up one or two comics that I was normally going to leave on the shelf. One of those we'll go over a little bit later with Near Death. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, but it definitely was a light week because we both do have a lot of DC comics in our stack. Mm-hmm. However, I think it'll just let the books that are not DC shine a little bit this month. And we got some other stuff that we're going to have at the end of this show.
Yeah, it kind of gives us a chance to dig a little bit more into news, something that we'd want to touch on more in our regular episodes, but we haven't really had much of a chance until this week. So hopefully we can kind of go through these things and really kind of get a feel for what stuff is worth putting out there, and then we'll try to incorporate that more into future episodes. So if you hear anything that you really like, please send us some feedback, let us know, so that way we can help to cater the show a little bit towards those of you who are listening and really put out something you guys will all enjoy. Anyways, starting off this week on the comics, let's hit it up with TMNT. This was number 4 of the new relaunch from IDW. Kevin Eastman, of course, still being very big on this title as he was in the original creation. Jason, what did you think about the title this week?
I was confused.
Understandable.
It still is holding the nostalgia from watching Turtles as a kid. I didn't read the comics, but I did watch the TV show. And my neighbors had the toys, so we were always playing with the toys. And still had a lot of the nostalgia feel. You still get to see all those characters. But this story is starting to show itself. You know, it's taken 4 issues for it to really start to congeal together as a coherent storyline to see where everything is headed. And I'm not sure where it's headed, which to some extent is actually a good thing. You know, you want a story to keep you guessing. You don't want to be able to go, oh, well, this is going to happen. So
But in the same vein, it's also kind of playing with some of the expectations. I'm trying to think of how best to put this, because there's a moment in the issue, and you and I both commented on this, where Splinter actually says something that makes you wonder, is this a continuation? Is this not a time paradox, but like a time loop of like something that's happened before?
Well, part of this, we have to, you know, go over what's happened in this issue, which, you know, it's revealed at the end of the previous issue that old Hob, who's the mutant cat that they introduced in issue 1, had grabbed Raph during the break-in and was carrying him away from the scene where the Turtles had all gotten the mutagen on him. So that explains why Raph wasn't with the original Turtles at the beginning of this series, and, you know, it wound up finding Casey Jones. Still not sure how the two of them are able to kick as much ass as they do throughout this book, having had no training. And this really reveals the timeline of it being about 15 months after the break-in that this is taking place. So, yeah, one of the big things is the researchers have decided they need to get Splinter back. Because Splinter, as the lab rat, was being treated with psychotropic drugs. You know, they were feeding his brain. And so it was giving him unique abilities as a regular rat. Now he's had the mutagen spilled on him and is mutated, so who knows where those are going to go in the future, and maybe that's what part of the confusion that we were talking about earlier. We'll get to that momentarily. But, you know, with that, he goes off and teaches Leonardo, Michelangelo, and Donatello ninjutsu, and somehow knows it himself in 15 months. That he's able to teach them. Meanwhile, old Hob shows back up at the lab where they're trying to recover after this break-in, and says, oh, you need that lab rat back so you can determine what chemicals you pumped him full of? I could help you with that.
And that, if I'm remembering, so the lab break-in was 15 months before the fight at the beginning of the entire story in issue 1.
Correct.
So he literally, as the cat, picked up Raphael, took him away, mutated into an anthropomorphic cat, walks back to the lab, pissed off with a scratch on his eye, and says, okay, I want to go get the rat for you.
Well, that wasn't 15 months. He actually...
No, I mean, that all happened in the same night.
Well,
at the break-in.
Yeah, during the break-in, he grabs Raphael, is attacked by Splinter, who scratches Hob's eye.
Right.
And that causes Hob to drop Raphael, which, being so close and being that Splinter was right there, how'd Raph get lost? But apparently it was far enough that Raph got lost when he mutated, and that old Hob is still right there in the alley when he mutates, and an hour or two later is there when the research doctors are going, how are we going to recover? We don't know what drugs we pumped into Splinter. Which, what kind of research facility doesn't keep notes on what they're pumping their test animals with? That's the whole point of being a research facility, is to know what you're doing to these animals.
Yeah, in all honesty, I mean, we're arguing semantic points on a comic that has to do with turtles that have mutated and are ninjas.
Right. So.
Yeah, I mean, we really are kind of stretching the bounds of believability in the first place. I don't think technical accuracy is really where we need to be griping on this book.
Yeah, but I do think that the researchers would have gone, that's unique, let's go test that. And would have taken Hob in, and instead of sending him to go find the rat, they would have started testing on Hob, and he would have become a lab rat himself. That aside, the real confusing part of this story is how Splinter starts acting as if he's been there before and done that.
Yeah,
is it a split timeline?
Well, yeah, because he actually mentions in the comic, he says, I believe, if I'm remembering the quote correctly, this is all as it is supposed to be, or something to that effect, which really sort of gives him this sort of like a precognizant knowledge, or like we said, there's something. Somehow Splinter knows that they are supposed to be the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, that he is supposed to be their father figure, their teacher, their sensei, and that all of these things are culminated and supposed to happen, but with zero explanation of exactly how he knows that. I can only assume they're going to explain it further along in the book. Or, in all honesty, maybe they won't. Maybe just give a big thumb to the readers of, hey, you know, hey, you guys, we don't really need to explain this to you. You'll get it. Let's just tell
they're
a fun story.
They're giant ninja turtles.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
So, yeah, but it does make me wonder and make me want them to explain that. You know, is it the side effect of the drugs that he's having delusions? You know,
great. Splinter on an acid trip. That's going to be hilarious.
Yeah, so... Yeah, and but it does make me go, okay, where did they all of a sudden start learning these ninja skills? You know, there have been various different stories, and hopefully we'll start to get some of that as this goes along. And who knows, maybe before he was a lab rat, Splinter was a sensei's rat and was shadowboxing with them.
Probably. Yeah.
We'll have to see where it goes. And actually, all these questions that are confounding us and making us go, does it have its own internal logic? And I think that's where it falls apart, is does it have its own internal logic? But that's what makes me want to keep reading it.
Yeah.
So,
well, one thing I will say that they did get continuity right on, and so I got to give credit where credit is due. Raph does not fight like a ninja. He fights like a street brawler. He bites. He kicks low. He fights dirty. Yes, that's the way that somebody that's been on the street is supposed to fight. Good up on that. You did it. You done it right.
Okay, so they're following their own logic on that. So that's good.
At least.
Okay.
So well, I think TMNT is an IDW book, so let's keep rolling with that. I think you have an IDW book that you read this week that I didn't, following in your love of war stories.
Yeah, and that was G.I. Joe Cobra, which G.I. Joe's got a spy in their midst, and they finally figure out who it is. This book is actually two parts. The first half is an origin story for a new G.I. Joe character they've created called Firewall, who wanted to be a field operative, but...
And wait, let me guess, got stuck behind a computer.
Actually, yes. Well, actually was a field operative due to injuries, was sidelined, fast-tracked her progress to try and get back on the firing line, and instead got stuck back at a desk job, which has put her... Yeah, she did an extremely good job at that, and this she got pulled into G.I. Joe. The second half of this is Firewall... revealing who the spy is to G.I. Joe, and is a confounding series of, why would you do that? You know, if you've got the spy in front of you, you've got a gun trained on him, I'm guessing since you were a trained combat operative and were trying to get back in the field, you're probably a qualified marksman with the handgun you're holding. And you even say, I'm going to stay at least 5 feet away from me. Yeah, the next panel shouldn't be that person being taken down. They know enough to be stepping back and away from the person as they're moving towards them, or to shoot the person. And I think they would hit that target. So there was a moment of that. You know, there are three Joes in here that get taken down by the spy, and I'm just going, how is this happening? These are all elite trained people, but how is this one, you know, turncoat able to take out the other two? I think part of this was just to stretch out some of the story to keep it, you know, where they need it to be in the progressive story arc as they get closer to revealing who the next Cobra Commander is and what's going to happen next. So,
just as a quick thing, it sounds like the character Firewall is similar to, I don't know, have you watched Covert Affairs on USA? Did you catch it at all?
I've seen an episode or two, yes.
The character Augie.
The blind guy?
Yeah. This sounds like Firewall is almost like a gender-flipped equivalent of Augie.
Except for she's not blind.
Well, handicapped in the field of battle. Whatever her, I don't know what her handicap was, so.
Well, and actually, physically, she's not handicapped.
Yeah. Like a PTSD or?
No, she was handicapped. She's worked her physical training. You know, she's gone through.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, you know, she's gone through rehab. She's not physically unable to perform. That's one of the things that frustrates her at the beginning of this book.
Okay.
So.
All right. Yeah. Interesting parallel, I thought was worth mentioning. So. You also read Near Death this week, which is another one that I know I haven't been following, but it's been interesting from what you've said.
Yeah. Again, this was a one and done, so I did love that about this. Yes! Yeah. But the story, just like the previous issue, this was issue 3, just like issue number 2, it felt like you've read this story before, you've seen similar stuff to this. However, this does lay the groundwork for what will hopefully be an overarching story. In this one, he's got a police detective who is actually being attacked by other police officers because she's got information proving that they're dirty. So, you know, she's trying to take down the dirty cops. He steps in to save her life. Yeah, and that's the whole premise of this, is he's an ex-hitman who steps in to save people's lives.
Mm-hmm.
But what's laid the groundwork is the officer that he saves is actually after him because although she can't prove it, she believes he killed her partner. So she's got a personal vendetta against him. She's willing to let it slide because he's keeping her alive in this issue, but she said she's still going to come after him. So we'll have to see. Hopefully that will develop. And I kind of like the idea of one and done, so hopefully the stories will get better. Hopefully, like Dollhouse, where the first couple of stories are actually fairly mundane stories, because without that mundane setup, you don't get
that good impact from the bomb dropping.
Yeah, when they really start to change what happens, or they start changing the effect of these types of missions, and things start going wrong on them, you don't have an appreciation for how they're going wrong versus how they're supposed to go. So,
okay.
Hopefully that's why the first couple of issues, and now that they've started to reveal an overarching story, they'll start bringing in some more pieces that they can tie in to stories as they move forward. So you'll have maybe one and done stories, but pieces and threads that are overarching throughout the run of the book.
Well, and you also might see, I would hope, cameos from those one and done. Somebody that he crossed paths with at one point or did something with in an earlier story, where they pop in and help with one little aspect of that overarching storyline, that overarching narrative.
Yeah, I think we're going to see this police detective again because she's already said she wants him for.
Yeah, she's already said she'll be back. Partner. So
yeah, and yeah, there are other hitmen that they've revealed throughout some of the other mm-hmm. issues. So yeah, is there going to be a hit put on him as a hitman turned to not being a hitman? And it's kind of the criminal. You can't get out unless you're dead. So it's likely he'll wind up with a hit on himself.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, you'll see those hitmen coming back into it. So I think some of this is set up for hopefully a longer arc that's maybe done as a series of one and dones, but you can still see a much larger picture going on. And I'm going to keep with it. I was thinking of dropping it, I'll keep with it maybe a little bit longer, another one or two issues, to see if it actually starts pulling that off.
It blossoms and whether it's worth to keep following.
Yeah. So, and yeah. Yeah, so those are the two, you know, major title books that I read, you know, not from Marvel and DC. I know you read an IDW book as well this week.
Yeah, the next Dungeons & Dragons was actually, now that I think about it, not out this week. It actually came out last week, but I missed it, and I finally managed to pick it up this week.
Oops.
Yeah, no, I just realized that. I will say, the cover that I got, there was two covers for this book. One was the Elven Ranger and the Dwarven Cleric on the front fighting, literally fighting the darkness, which... If you've ever heard of the Dead Alewives, you'll be able to get a chuckle at that particular reference. The other cover, though, I truly appreciated. It was their thief, the halfling Bree, holding three daggers in her fist in between her fingers with a come here crook to her other finger. Yes, Polio gets it, just like the Wolverine cover.
Yeah.
It was fantastically done. I'll show it to you later so you can get a good... even better chuckle out of it. Anyways, though, to get to the inside of the book, this is continuing the new arc that they've started following their dwarven cleric, Cal, in his search for his true love, who has been, well, doesn't really know, actually. She's kind of up and disappeared. His mother-in-law, or mother-in-law-to-be, hates his guts, tries to kill him and the party, feels that her daughter not only is either dead or is the reason that their entire dwarven citadel is now being overrun by these bugs from hell. And basically they're trying to run away from her while killing the bugs and trying to find his fiance. So we are mid-arc, obviously. I've said this before about the book, and I'm going to continue to reiterate it because it's really worth saying. I can actually hear... players sitting around a table saying the things that these characters are saying in the book. And just like when you're playing a tabletop RPG, a player will say something completely out of character, and it ends up becoming what the character actually says, either because it's so funny or it becomes a running gag or something else along those lines. The characters in this title are doing those exact same things. They'll utter something that's not necessarily completely out of character for them, but doesn't fit completely, and it's hilarious. The Elven Ranger, for instance, in this one, instead of being the rather solemn and, you know, a plume sort of guy that he's been, actually, I think, falls down four times in this book. And after every single time, he just keeps going, why do I keep falling? I hate falling. This sucks. I hate falling. And literally, one of them is hate falling, as he's landing on his face. So... another good one, and this is indicative of the character, but you can still see a player doing it, is Bree and the rest of the party are standing up about to fight, I forget what it is, some type of big baddie, you know, big rock golem or something. And so they all turn around, Indiana Jones style, with the, and the golem pops up, and they're all standing there shocked, and Bree's the only one that turns around and says, see ya, pew, and runs off. Picking the door to get into the citadel to save herself. By the time they retreat back to where she is, they're like, hey, good job on the door, Bree. And she's like, oh, yeah, I did that for you. Thanks. Okay. So, anyways.
With a book like Dungeons & Dragons, I think it's great that you do get that feeling of these are characters that were played, that this is the scenario that they did role-playing this game.
Yeah, and I don't know if it actually is that case. I mean, I really could see the writers doing a game and taking their adventures in the game and writing it into a comic. You saw Penny Arcade do things similar to this, actually, when they were doing their live-action RPG for Penny Arcade Expo. Afterwards, Krahalik and Holkins actually took their game sessions and made a short series of comic strips out of their game. That really could... I mean, this feels like it could be the case in this comic as well. That's something worth researching into to see if that is actually the case or not.
But again, I think it bodes well for a comic called Dungeons & Dragons that it feels like you're playing the game Dungeons & Dragons.
Absolutely. So, and as an added bonus, just as a bonus material to the book, a lot of times what they've been doing at the back, especially if they introduce a new monster or something that they've never fought before, they'll actually give you the D&D stats for that monster in the
monster
back of the book.
Sheets!
Yeah.
Fourth edition rules?
Yeah, it's fourth edition.
Okay.
Because, well, I mean, that's the current edition. Depending upon rumors, there have been some rumors rumbling around that fifth edition is actually in the works already. So I'm curious to see.
Wow, that's pretty quick for a new edition.
Yeah, but we're talking about Wizards of the Coast. I mean, this isn't TSR anymore. This isn't the old hat that it used to be. Look at how many different versions of Magic there are. I mean, this is... Wizards will never say this is how they make their money, but this is how they make their money.
Yeah, you got to have a new edition to sell the new books, so...
Yeah, and there have been enough complaints that about 4th edition. I mean, there's complaints about every edition, don't get me wrong. Okay. But there have been enough complaints about 4th edition specifically that people have said they're rolling back to using Pathfinder 3.5. You know, using a completely non-Wizard product because they feel it's a better and more balanced game than what 4th edition was, especially with all the errata and other stuff they've had to put out to make it playable. That I think Wizards has said, yeah, you know what, maybe this is just kind of a failed experiment. Let's pitch it and move on.
It could be that. It could also be that, you know, character that people that have been playing with, you know, D&D 3, you know, version 3.5 didn't want to move forward. So, and because it was a huge difference between D&D 3 versus D&D 4, they went and did Pathfinder, which is just D&D 3. They've just called it something different so they can get away with the rights. The rules are pretty much the same as D&D 3, so.
Well, it was the D20 system, which Wizards made open. So, for them to adopt it, it's not any type of legal issue.
Right. Well, excited for the name. They can't call it Dungeons & Dragons.
Well, no. It's Pathfinder based on the D20 system.
So. Right. All right. Moving on to comics again.
Yes, back to comics. Hey, we said we'd talk about other geek stuff. That's cool. It's.
I'm just bringing us back in circles. I didn't say it was wrong.
All right. Next, let's talk about the Green Lantern animated Zero issue that came out this week. This was one of the few actual DC issues that came out this week.
And part of the reason I picked it up is because I was feeling left out of having no DC in my stack. Part of it is because we did get a question about the animated series, and I am interested in seeing how the animated series is going to be. So since this is the comic based on the animated series, I wanted to see what it was like. And, yeah. I think for Cartoon Network, this is probably a good choice. Yeah. They did take the Red Lanterns and change their power a little bit. Instead of vomiting a acidic blood, they now can create constructs, it's certainly much more kid-friendly, which for Cartoon Network, or even since I'm sure this book is aimed for younger readers, for, you know, parents to read to their kids, or for, you know, 8-year-olds that are reading on their own that want to read a comic book.
This is more the independent readers. I mean, I think they'd have to be old enough to be able to read on their own to really be able to appreciate it.
Story follows, you know, Hal Jordan, the traditional Earth Green Lantern, and Kilowog, who's been the...
I would dare say probably the most well-known of the alien GLs.
Yeah, probably. He was the drill sergeant, and that was what he was known as for a long time, as a Green Lantern. The two of them go out...
Oh, sorry, just as a quick add-in, for those of you who aren't necessarily big followers of Green Lantern, Kilowog is the big pink one that says Poozer a lot.
Yes.
That should help you out.
And so they go out to find what appears to be a random green ring floating in space. You know, they follow the energy signature and get ambushed by Red Lanterns and have to fight their way out.
I got to say, with the Red Lanterns, especially with them building constructs, it almost feels like they're just making a core of what were previously Sinestro. Like, Sinestro was back in the day. Before he had his own core, before he did his other stuff, it was always Green Lantern versus Sinestro, Green Ring versus Yellow Ring. And now you have a Green Lantern core with Hal and Kilowog, and I'm sure the others that they'll bring in over time, and you're going to have the Red Lanterns, and it's going to be just green versus red. I mean, it's going to be go versus stop. And I can understand. This is for a Cartoon Network show. This is supposed to be for kids, which, keep it simple. I mean, yeah, the KISS method works, by all means, fine. But that does mean it's going to translate well into a comic. And especially not necessarily for a comic that is going to be on a general rack. If it's going to be on the kids' rack next to Young
Which
Justice, Tiny Titans.
I think it will. Batman Adventures was there. Yeah. So I certainly see this being, at least on the, usually placed over by the kids' rack once it's off this week. But you remember the Adventures of Batman based on Batman the Animated Series. That was done so well that adults as well as kids could follow it. Now, as far as this being a Zero issue, I was hoping for maybe sort of an origin story. As a Zero issue, they can give an origin without having to have it be a full story. It can be a bit more of a standalone because it's a backup for what you're going to see.
Well, but instead what we get is essentially an episode of the TV show.
Right.
A one-and-done episode, which isn't bad for a zero issue. It's a perfect way to have an introduction. It's, well, here's what one episode of the show is going to be like.
But then why wasn't it one? Yeah, a zero issue is something that takes place before the main arc or sets up the main arc. Yeah, it could be an origin story that you're not going to be able to tell because you're jumping into an arc and you're going to tell that arc. So for me, it wasn't really much of a zero issue. It was more of just a straight one as a one-and-done title. Mm-hmm. The other thing is, like we were talking about, why didn't they use the Sinestro Corps and the Yellow Lanterns? They're a bit more well-known, I think. And what
I think that might actually be the exact reason why they didn't, is because the Sinestro Corps got oversaturated.
That or the fact that the Red Lanterns have their own title as an adult book, they've been getting a good push recently. They're probably trying to tie it in. Well, so that
riding the wave, more likely. Yeah,
as people are watching the show, as older kids start graduating to reading, you know, the regular books as opposed to the kids' books.
They would transition naturally to the GL, GL Corps, New Guardians, and Red Lanterns.
Right.
Yeah, I can see that. That makes sense.
The other thing that kind of irked me is they were just Red Lanterns. There wasn't a specific Red Lantern that they brought out that they highlighted.
Yeah.
Yeah. I could kind of see them not really dealing with Atrocitus directly. Yeah,
leave him until later. Make him a big villain. You know, make that a big story.
Or just the shadow that you see in the background type of thing.
Yeah.
But, yeah. I know, you know, Dexstar would have been great to have show up.
Yes.
Yeah. Who's a pissed off, angry cat.
Psycho Kitty.
Say cat, we mean your standard tabby house cat.
Yep.
Except for he's pissed off.
And in the adult comics, puking plasma blood, you know? And not like plasma, like the stuff your blood is in. Okay. Plasma is in like the crap stars are made of. Plasma blood. Awesome.
So, a couple of things that were didn't really hit for me on this. And overall, it was just okay. Yeah. If this is how the series is, I can see it'll do well for Cartoon Network. I don't think it's going to get the acclaim that you saw from Batman the Animated Series.
Yeah, and actually, I think, I don't even know if it necessarily will do well on Cartoon Network. I think it may end up getting lost in the shuffle. There's enough other good shows on Cartoon Network that I don't think this will stand out at all. And I had mentioned before, I think, when we had the question last week, that I wasn't very into this because I just didn't particularly care for the art style. And I felt the same way about the comic. The art style that's in there is what has become the staple for most mainstream cartoon shows nowadays, where they take the idea of the character, they iconify it enough to make it very, very simple to draw repeatedly, which doesn't make sense necessarily nowadays because it's all CG anyways. You can have a complex model that you can throw a skin on and do whatever with, but they instead go with this oversimplified graphic style. It's very much the Bruce Timm style as well, where it's the very like rounded edges with the harsh wedge shape upper body, the almost like non-existent extremities.
It's kind of
very, very simplistic extremities, very simplistic.
It's kind of a combination of the Teen Titans and the Batman Animated Series art styles. It's somewhere right in between there.
Actually, I would say probably a better explanation would be if it's Batman the Animated Series, but done as a 3D CG.
Yeah.
Because that's what it has kind of come down to.
But, yeah, again, and it's also going up against Young Justice, which I've seen an episode or two of, and that actually is a real good cartoon. So, yeah, I think it's got a big head of steam that it's got to build up to be able to stand out.
Young Justice hasn't made its way to Netflix yet, has it?
No.
It's still like first or second season.
I'll let you know.
Yeah. So keep me posted.
Okay. But you did read another DC title this week that actually came out.
Yeah, I dare say the other DC title that came out this week. or at least the other one worth mentioning. There were a bunch of Vertigo titles, so that's...
Yay, Vertigo!
Big fan of Vertigo. Anyways, Uncharted, which is the spinoff from the PlayStation games, which the third one in the series of the franchise recently came out. This was an enjoyable title. It was an enjoyable story. I have never played the Uncharted games, much to my personal shame, being, you know, I do like to try to characterize myself as a gamer, but I don't have a PS3, so it's a PlayStation exclusive. I can't play it. I've watched others play it, so I at least am familiar enough with the character and the character's unique personality. And I don't feel that personality, which is really, truly, I think, the core of the game. The gameplay itself, from what I saw, was almost like a Assassin's Creed meets shooter, which is good, is fun. But that game centers around the personality of Nathan Drake. His smarmy, smart aleck, you know, always has a quip or something to say regardless of the situation. In moving that to a print version and into a comic book, you lose that attitude. You lose that swagger, that iconic thing that makes him who he is. There have been debates online because they're talking about doing the Uncharted movie of who should be playing Nathan Drake. And I remember Nathan Fillion, I believe, being at the top of that list.
Of course he was.
Well, but in all honesty, for this character, I mean, there are other things like Hal that people said they wanted Nathan in, which is nice, but I could see why people would debate Fillion not being a good fit for that role. Nathan Drake, I swear, is written to be played by Nathan Fillion. I mean,
as Captain Mal Reynolds.
Yes. As Mal Reynolds minus the future. Right. You know, still the gunslinger, still the smarmy jackass, but...
And I can actually see that going against him. He's already done something like that, and arguably it didn't work. I mean, everybody that's seen Firefly that I know loves the show.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah. Then again, the studios canceled it. You know, Fox said, nope, get rid of it. Because they also put it on Friday nights, and who watches TV on Friday nights?
Yeah, and Fox are morons. So, yeah. Well, and the announcement that I think was, Mark Wahlberg, they were going to have play him. Didn't he already get his crack at it with Max Payne and he fucked that up too? So
he did do Max Payne. I didn't see the movie. I can't see
it. Yeah, nobody saw the movie. That's the point.
It doesn't mean it's bad. It just means nobody was convinced to go see it. That means it's a bad marketing department.
No, it means the movie sucked too.
It probably does.
Yeah, they had their choice to see it on video and I didn't see any, you know, cult following of the video sales either.
Let me go look it up on Netflix and now I'll do that.
Never. Yeah, Put it on your to-do list. Anyways, getting back to the point I was trying to make, I don't feel that the personality transitions well to print. It may be a failing of the medium, to be honest. I don't know if something like that really can transition over very well. This is something that I've mentioned the Dresden File adaptations before, and it's a failing in those as well. For as good as those adaptations are, and they truly are fantastic adaptations, there's just something lost. Unless you've heard the voice before and you have it in your head the entire time while you're reading the book and you know exactly what it's supposed to sound like and what it's supposed to be like, then you're not going to get it. And it's not going to come through well.
Yeah, it's very hard to take a property and transfer it to another medium. Everybody from Bill Goldman talks about it, Adventures in the Screen Trade, and how something that works in a book doesn't work in a movie. Which when you're going from a book to a movie, that not only is it, you know, that you're no longer in the character's head or you can do a voiceover, but how many characters can you do a voiceover for?
Mm-hmm.
Whereas in a book, you just pop into the next person's head. There's, you know, the points of view can change from we're with the villain to the hero to a third party. It's real easy to do that with a book. In a movie, it's a lot more difficult. Yeah. Books are the ultimate storytelling medium. You can be anywhere you want. You can have them do anything they want. There's nothing that's off limits.
Unless you make those limits yourself. Or the author does, I should say.
There are no limits on what the author can do that he's not imposing upon himself.
Yeah.
When you start getting into something like a comic book, now it's how much time is it going to take the artist to draw that, but you can still pretty much do anything. You just may have to allow a little bit more time. Mm-hmm. Or if you're going to have something be longer, now you've got to allow more time for more artwork.
And there's the argument, too, that a comic book should show you the story more than tell you the story.
Yes.
The last thing you want is to have a wall of text as, you know, this giant suppository, you know, this big exposition in dialogue when it could be done so much better through literally showing you.
Well, that's part of the problem is sometimes you can't show it, or to show it would be an entire issue in and of itself that's two paragraphs in a book.
Or it puts an undue stress on the artists themselves as well, especially when it comes down to things like conveying emotion or thoughts or social interaction.
Right.
They can try to convey it as well as they can through, you know, alterations in the face of the characters, doing a close-up on a big panel spread of somebody's face to really, really pull that out. And this is all stuff that, if you've ever read Scott McCloud's Understanding Comics, he talks about these types of things and what's required to get the feeling across and to get the mood across and to get the unspoken across. Because as humans, we have that ability to communicate these things.
Right.
We already said, as we mentioned, facial features and other types of things. And it's how do we best mimic that in a single panel on a page with a single shot, you know, because it's like that moment-to-moment thing. And a lot of times it's actually the movement or the interaction in time that really is what is able to convey it and not the individual snapshots.
And then, well, to take this a step further, you go into a television show or a movie. Television shows have even less budget than movies. Mm. And with the movie and TV, you're now dealing with actors and expenses. You know, it's expensive to go out on location and shoot. Mm-hmm. If you've got a story that takes place over, you know, 15 years, you know, you could start off with the character as a boy, then the character's a man, you know, you can even go longer than that. Now he's an old man. You have to do that. Do you do that with makeup, with CGI? And they did some of that with Benjamin Button's.
I was just about to say, however you do it with Brad Pitt, because he'll be able to get an Oscar out of it.
But yeah, but then you start throwing in locations. You know, if you want to do something in a book that takes place on the face of Mount Rushmore, you just write it takes place on the face of Mount Rushmore, on the nose and the right nostril of Abraham Lincoln. If you want to do that on a comic book, the artist just types up, you know, Mount Rushmore, takes a whole bunch of photos from Google, and then is able to draw fairly realistically Mount Rushmore and what's going on there. You do that with a movie, now you've got to either do it on a green screen, in which case you've got to light a set with green screen, and then have CG artists come in the background and create the imagery that goes behind the actors, or do it on set. Good luck trying to get actually on Mount Rushmore.
Mm-hmm.
And now you've got to, you know, all the expense of going out there, renting out the entire state park,
just
the riggings,
Cage.
The safety effects of being out there, or you've got to build an entire set, which is the cost of building the set. Yeah. Whereas, yeah, you want to do something in space, now you've got to create a whole space station or, you know, space effects behind you. It's a lot easier to draw that, and it's even easier to write a book telling you about that. So a book can go anywhere. It's not limited by anything. A comic book is limited by the amount of space and time, and to some extent the talent of the artist, but mostly the space and time of, you know, how long is this story going to be? How much does it take up in your comic book versus the rest of the story? And then a movie, you start getting into budget and timing, you know, and again, you know, the natural effects of aging. You know, you have a kid that's 5 at the beginning of the story, who's 15 in the middle of the story, who's 27, and then who's 40 at the end. Easy to do that in books and comics, not so easy in a movie.
Which I realize we completely left video games out of that entirely, which is what the start of this really came from anyways.
Well, and video games are somewhere right in between movies and comics, because it's an entirely digitally created world, which you could use that type of a world to create scenes in movies,
but in the same
and you do have voice acting.
Yeah, but in the same vein, the characters themselves a lot of times tend to be mocap, so you still have the actor aspect of it.
Right.
Or at least to a certain point.
Right.
But then other pieces of it do need to be digitally enhanced or altered after the fact, which then you start getting into practical effects of movie making along with digital effects of game making and the storytelling aspects of comics or novel media.
And the other effect is that with games, you also have to compensate for what the character is going to do, particularly in an open sandbox game,
or like, the player's going to do,
like Grand Theft Auto, what the player's going to do with that character, you know, if they turn around, you got to have something there for them to look at, even if you don't intend for them to be able to complete the game by going in that direction.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a whole lot that you have to build into a game, even around, and in fact, games are rivaling the budgets of movies now, maybe even, you know, higher than a lot of blockbusters.
Yeah, it's just as big of a budget as what the latest news have said. And at the risk of expanding this rabbit hole any further, just a bit of trivia for those of you out there who are fans of Firefly. They did, in fact, have the entire Firefly built as a set from stem to stern in a studio that the actors did, in fact, move through.
Love it.
Fun little bit of a little trivia for you there. So, yeah, the spaceship itself was, in fact, one giant practical set.
Well, they also had to do the same thing for the West Wing on the West Wing TV show because Aaron Sorkin loves those walking and talking scenes, so you had to be able to walk from one room to the other, continuous shot all the way through the White House.
Well, which makes sense, because if you're working in the White House, that's what you're doing. You're walking and talking. You're not standing still, and you're not shutting up.
Yeah, Sorkin does that in almost all of his movies and TV shows. It's one of his trademarks. But
anyway, now that we have dug ourselves a grave with that particular thing, I hope all of you out there are fans of Uncharted or fans of movie making because, you just got an earful. Anyways, moving on. Next up, we were planning to talk about, Ultimates. Ultimates number 4, which you read.
Yep, Marvel Comics.
I've been thinking and thinking about picking up Ultimates, actually starting at 1 and going through, because I've been told more than a few times that it really is a good, fun title. But I have yet to hear a specific reason as far as why it is such a fun, good title.
Yeah.
Lay it on me.
Okay, because actually, there's part of me that's going, this is the best thing I'm reading from Marvel right now. And it didn't quite start off that way, but the story's been building and it's been getting better. In issue 3, Nick Fury, Iron Man, Thor, the Ultimates attacked the giant mushroom city that popped up in the middle of the desert. And yeah, in issue 3, they were repelled. At the end of the issue, Thor says, screw this, I'm not... Yeah, they've destroyed Asgard. They've taken the tree Yggdrasil that holds up Asgard from Earth. I'm taking these guys down. And he teleports himself into the middle of the giant mushroom-shaped city.
As a quick interjection, okay. What is the difference between the Ultimates and the Avengers?
The Ultimate Universe versus the standard Marvel Universe.
That's really the only practical difference.
That's the practical difference.
Okay.
There are things that have happened in the different universes that have caused different changes, but Ultimates for that extent.
Is there an Ultimate Avengers?
No. The Ultimate Avengers would be the Ultimates. That's what it's come down to.
Okay.
And to some extent, a bit more in the Ultimates universe, they're led by Nick Fury.
As opposed to Cap
slash Iron Man in the standard Marvel universe.
Mm-hmm.
So Thor goes in there to kick some ass and instead has his ass handed to him.
Fantastic.
Yes. He, shows up in the nursery, finds out a little bit about, where these beings grow and develop, is told where to find Captain Britain, rescues him, and then proceeds to have his ass handed to him. And he does also find out who the actual leader of these people are. If you heard my review earlier, I talked about how this is a city that is caught in its own time bubble, so it's actually evolved several hundred years ahead of us, maybe even thousands of years ahead of us, even though for our world it's only been a year. So they're way technologically advanced, which is how they're able to capture the Asgardian magic and kick Thor's ass. At the end of this, Thor is sent back to Fury with his tail between his legs and basically says, look, they've done what they're going to do. They've expanded the city. They've grown it. They said, let us have our city. Leave us alone. And you won't have to deal with us. We won't have to fight, and they won't have to come kick our asses. And I'm not going to reveal who it is, but he also reveals to Fury and Iron Man just who it is that created the Mushroom City and is their leader. The other interesting side note of this is Thor actually has Odin call back to him, and the Warriors 3, as well as the rest of Valhalla, basically saying, Thor, next time you go into battle, we're going to be with you. You are now Valhalla. So it could be very interesting to see what happens in the next issue when Thor finally decides to strike back if he takes the full force of the Odin force, as well as the Warriors 3, Valhalla, all the Norse warriors. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Powered through him, so we just might find out just how powerful this god can be.
You would think God would be fairly well explanatory of how powerful he can be. You would think.
And yet he had his ass handed to him. Actually, Captain Britain actually tells him, get up, you can't retreat. He goes, I'm not running away. I'm defeated. He actually admits defeat. Yeah. So, yeah.
You're not saying, and I haven't read it, but I'm going to throw out a guess that this is some deity on deity action going on here.
No, not deity on deity. Okay. But it's certainly, it's interesting because this is a relaunch of the Ultimates. It is the fourth issue of the new run.
Right.
But you can tell there are elements of things that have happened in the previous two Ultimates runs. They did an Ultimates and an Ultimates 2 series before this. So, yeah. However, you don't actually have to have read those to understand what's going on here. There are elements that kind of piece together. And yeah, I know one thing that we mentioned, and we'll probably get into this as we discuss the rest of the Marvel comics that we read this week, is there seems to be something missing. I don't think this book is missing it. There is something that's missing from a number of the Marvel books. This one, I think, has it. And
the je ne sais quoi that we've been trying to put a finger on.
Yeah, there's something different about the Marvel style versus the DC style. And reading these stories, we're trying to understand what it is that's different about the style, what we feel is missing from the Marvel.
Mm-hmm.
Or maybe it's there, we don't recognize it, or it's done differently for us that we're not picking up because we've been reading DC for so long. Yeah. But
both very distinct possibilities.
Yes. So, yeah.
Okay.
But
might have to start picking this up then. Actually, I think I know what I'll do.
No, you won't.
Yeah. Probably like issue 7, I'll start picking it up. So that way I can just, once it comes out in trade, because I'm sure it will, in fact, come out in trade, I'll get the first trade and then kind of try to pick it up from there and roll with it to see if, just to catch up. This does sound like a title that I would enjoy reading, that I would enjoy following from week to week. So.
Yeah. It started off a little weak, but I've been enjoying this more and more each week, so.
Okay.
Speaking
of the other Marvel titles, which one do you want to hit next? Do you want to hit Uncanny, or do you want to hit Ghost Rider?
Let's go with Ghost Rider first, and then we'll hit Uncanny.
Well, you take the reins on this one, because like I said, you had this one pretty well pegged, and all I had was some...
Snark?
Yeah, yeah, pretty much.
Well, okay. First off, another one and done. Hooray!
Yay! Hooray for one and done's.
Yeah, I really enjoy...
Let me rephrase that. Hooray for one and done's done well.
Yes.
There are one and done's out there that you look at it, you're like, okay, this is trash. Why didn't you pick it up? You throw it to the side. This is a one and done done well because it's Monster of the Week. It's, just a simple story. There's nothing complex about it, but it still seems to be propelling this character forward.
Yeah, and that's the thing, is it does propel the character forward. This is a story of redemption. Both Alejandra, the girl who now has the Ghostwriter spirit inside of her.
And whose name I could never freaking remember.
As well as the town that she visits. She goes to this town and finds out that the people in there are looking for redemption. They are all murderers, and they're looking for a way to be set free from their sins of murder. They're looking for that redemption. This one character pulls her out and says, this is what we're after. And, what she discovers after meeting this one character that is telling her, I'm looking for my redemption. I'm looking to be saved for what I've done. That the rest of the town does not feel that way, that there is no redemption. And Alejandra feels that same way too. She feels, and we see it both through her interactions with the other characters in this book and through her actions, that there is no redemption for her. We hear it in her. She tells us as readers, there is no redemption. You've done crimes, you pay for them, but you will never be redemption. She's out for vengeance. She's going to take revenge for the things that they did that were wrong. But they can't be redeemed because she's out for her vengeance. They can't be redeemed, from their sins.
She's not the spirit of redemption. She is the spirit of vengeance.
Right.
Which, in itself, it is the crux of the title. And although she wants...
Actually, it's not the subtitle of this one, which is that.
Is that what it was?
No.
It's not Spirit of Vengeance?
Yeah, it's just Ghost Rider. So,
All right.
But Ghost Rider, it traditionally has been the Spirit of Vengeance.
Right. Well, so, Zarathustra? No, that's a classical song. Zarathos, I think, something like that.
Yeah.
Anyways, is the Spirit of Vengeance, not Alejandra. Well, she is, or at least was, looking for redemption for her actions. And this is, for those of you who don't know, she received the Ghost Rider as part of Fear Itself, as a Fear Itself sideline. Something occurred during Fear Itself when she had the power that she feels guilty about. Luckily, it did not, in fact, ever come to pass the way that it was intended, but it could have, and I think that's what she's feeling guilty about more than anything else. So, as she is looking for this redemption as far as, you know, what's going to assuage her guilt, and she had thought that it would be forgiveness or some type of blessing.
Yeah. Or instead, saving others. Yeah. In the previous issue, she saves people that are in a slave trade from being traded, and she kills off the leader of the slave trade.
And, rather brutally.
Yeah. And she's looking for the redemption at that point. And so you see her move from that search of redemption to this book, where she really does and realizes, based on this town, that there is no redemption. There's only vengeance.
Right.
And that's an important issue. It's something that this book actually is able to make. We've talked about Red Hood and the Outlaws, you know, previously, and I haven't been liking that book. And this book does something that that book hasn't been able to do, which is show the character is irredeemable. And you're in the head of the character, and you understand why she's irredeemable, why she doesn't feel like she can be saved. She's just out there for vengeance.
Yeah, or at least why she feels she doesn't deserve to be saved.
They're not defining the characters and the poor dream sequences that they did in Robin Hood or Red Hood. Yeah, Red Hood and the Outlaws, which Robin was based on Robin Hood.
Yeah.
Of course, Robin was Jason Todd when he was working with Batman and is now the Red Hood. So there is a tie in there. But I don't think they've been able to develop that in that DC book. They haven't been able to show these characters with the depth that they've actually been able to show Alejandra in these two issues that I've read of Ghost Rider.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Yeah, is that just... I don't know if that's coming just from the writing itself. The writing in here is just that much better, that you have a character that you can get this greater nuance out of that you don't get out of the DC characters. Actually, maybe it's the other way around, where this character is maybe written a little bit more plainly. It's a bit more kind of out there and direct, so you can really get a good grip on the character and a true understanding of what she's doing because it's explained, whereas in Outlaws, maybe it's kept a little too vague.
It's a little too far to reach.
Yeah, you have to really kind of dig to get it, as opposed to it being sort of just laid out there for you.
Yeah.
I've always said, and this is honestly not a dig at Marvel. It really isn't. It may sound like one. I apologize to all of you out there who are Marvel readers. To me, Marvel books have always seemed more simplistic. They've always seemed to be more just straightforward, you good guy, me good guy, you bad guy, me punch bad guy, story over. And I know there's more to them than that. I know there's deeper stories to it, but... You know, perfect example as a throwback to something we discussed before, which is Schism. The final book of Schism, where Cyclops and Wolverine are having their slugfest while a frickin' Sentinel is pounding on them. Have you heard of priorities, jackasses? You know,
that's the thing everybody goes back to in that book.
I know, but, you know, everybody's wanted that Cyclops-Wolverine beatdown. It's a fanboy dream, especially for Marvel fanboys. And the fact that that conflict takes center stage when a giant stinking robot is about to nuke your dumbass, to me, just, it's story not in the right place. It's, how do I explain it? I mean, it's just,
why would you do that?
Yeah, really, it's total, what the?
It's really, do we kick this guy's ass and then continue to kill each other? Okay, let's do that. Which, actually, it's interesting because, and actually I'm kind of pulling us right out of where we're at now, we're going into X-Men, because that's what you see in X-Men. There's actually a moment where they go, uh-oh. Yeah, and then in the first issue, they wake up the Celestial, and now Scott's told the other Celestials are on their way, and Scott goes, uh-oh, we've got bigger issues than just dealing with Sinister going on now, which is one of the reasons why they go into a parlay with Sinister. Mm-hmm. They know it's a trap, but they're like, we got to deal with him. because we got to stop this fight because the Celestials are coming and we don't know what havoc's coming with them. Yeah. So it's better to have, the enemy of my enemy is my friend scenario for them.
Very much. Very much.
So,
good segue.
X-Men this week, Uncanny X-Men number 2. I did enjoy it. There were moments where the dialogue is like, really?
Painful.
That's
painful.
Yeah, that really just poke me in the eye next time. And
what was you pointed out to me earlier this week?
It was Scott.
Yeah, stop acting sinister, or something like that. Where it's just it's facepalm worthy.
Yeah, it really is. Some of the dialogue was really bad. Hope at the beginning of this is doing your best impression of Michael McManus, which is Stephen Baldwin's character in The Usual Suspects, where he's sitting there counting the bad guys and then calls Oswald a fag. Because he's about to take out 8 guys and Oswald only had to take one.
Just to clarify, that was not Hope calling Oswald a fag.
No, that was...
That was McManus.
That was McManus in The Usual Suspects. That's from the line.
And an important clarification, I think, to make for anybody that is thinking about reading this title and, just saying.
But, so it starts off with that.
Let me jump in quick because for as much poor dialogue as in this... There's some really good dialogue, I should say, there's a very good monologue in this. Sinister has a tirade in the middle that is so egomaniacal, that is so narcissistic, and is so blatant that even he, the entire time, is going, "Hey, I'm an egomaniac. Give me my 5 minutes. It's all I want," and just goes into a tirade.
He monologues right in the middle of The Incredibles, and it's
but he does it in such a way that. Basically, every time somebody tries to jump in and screw with his monologue, he swats him away with a fly and is like, "No, bitches, I'm the top of this food chain. I'm going to sit here and preen and prance and give my monologue, and there ain't shit you guys can do about it." Ha, 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 ha.
And that's what he does.
And it's fantastic. And I love that.
And there are several occasions in here where you see the X-Men pull a rabbit out of a hat to try and, there's double crosses, there's backup plans, there's hidden plans, and in the end, Sinister is just kind of going, away, you're bothering me, I'm trying to monologue here, let me get my evil plan out.
I think what I like most about it is that it's done tongue-in-cheek, but not tongue-in-cheek, because... It's blatant. Like I said, it's blatant. He's doing it, and he's doing it just flat out in the open and says flat out to them, "Hi, I am monologuing now."
Yeah, I'm being the villain telling you exactly what my evil plan is, and not only is it the opportunity where you would normally come in and stop me from it, you can't do that. I'm that powerful right now.
I will have my monologue. God damn you.
So I think we could both say we enjoyed this book.
Yeah. I will say... I found a couple continuity things in it that I thought were kind of odd. This is spoiler-ish for those of you who are going to read it. When he takes the shot to the forehead, he literally says before then, "I'm going to step outside and get shot now," and he steps outside and gets shot. But in the next scene, you see him collapsed on the dais in front of his throne. So I don't know if that was something that I missed, that's not actually where he is, or...
I
think they actually screwed up continuity there, that he actually... I mean, he's doing the whole multiple places at the same time thing, so maybe, just one of him stepped out to get shot while the other one was still on the dais, or the one that stepped out front wasn't the one that Hope actually shot, and she did, in fact, shoot the one inside. I'm not really sure, and that, because of that, it kind of pulled me out for a minute.
And... Just to clarify here, there are multiple Mr. Sinisters walking around at this point in time. There are
everybody.
Yeah, just about
everybody.
Except for the X-Men are Sinisters. Yeah. And some are dressed like ancient English explorers that were exploring India. Some are dressed...
Not Keystone Cop. Colonial soldiers, I guess, would be a good way to put it.
Yeah. There are all sorts of different styles. You actually get a little bit of an origin for Mr. Sinister in here.
Which is nice.
As part of his monologue. Yeah. And they do show you the origin as opposed to just tell you. So there is a bit... Mm-hmm. So they do take advantage of the medium and showing you, not telling you. Overall, it was a well-done comic. And maybe just going back and rereading that section will explain what you thought was out of continuity. Maybe. Sometimes it's just artistic license. And it's a better scene to have him in the dais. Sometimes it's just artistic. And, well, there was one thing at the beginning of this book. You open it up, and it's Hope sitting on a rooftop sniping. And then the next scene And then you turn the page to a two-page spread, and it's a low point of view. And I'm going, that's rather jarring. If you're showing me a sniper, I want that sniper's point of view on that next two-page spread.
Especially since
it's her voice that we're hearing, I want to see her view, not even through the scope, just her view of a rooftop looking down on that battle scene. You know, it could even be a zoomed-in view a little bit, but I kind of want to get her experience since I'm hearing her voice, and you just spent a page, page and a half of giving me what she's doing. I want to, her best McManus impression. I want to see her view on that two-page spread. But it's an artistic choice. It's what they did. I don't have that artistic ability to be able to draw this comic. Okay, I probably couldn't draw XKCD, but
you can do XKCD. What's the other one? Cyanide and Happiness. That'd probably be pushing, I think, for you.
Yeah.
That's multiple artists though, because they do multiple styles. Last thing to say about Uncanny, really quick, just as another personal gripe that I had, is the fact that turning Colossus into the dumb brute kind of character, which, I'm sorry, Colossus has had a brain. He's had a brain for years. I understand he's got the Juggernaut thing going on, but Juggernaut was no Riri either, so I don't understand why it's turning him into a mental midget.
Yeah.
A mental little person.
So, a little bit of nitpicks there. Overall, the issue was fun.
When you read
a comic book, you want a fun book. And so I think we can say that is highly recommended for books this week.
And speaking of recommendations and trying to do segues as good as you did, we actually had one that was – this is a trade that was recommended to us.
Yes.
From a listener.
Warren Ellis and Colleen Duran, a book called Orbiter.
And – as a general rule, if Warren Ellis has a name on it, I'm all over it. I had never heard of this. Yeah. This was completely out of left field for me, which surprised me because I thought I had a pretty good grip on his catalog of works. And this one, I just had no idea.
I loved it. I'm going to start it off and straight up say I love this. I don't know if I loved it more than you. I think I may have, but because I was raving about this book, I didn't want to put it down. I unfortunately had the experience of picking it up when I wasn't able to sit and read it all the way through. And thus I'd get to a point and go, I have to go to sleep now so I can go to work. But I want to continue reading.
Yeah.
Because I really did love this book. There's a mystery part of it as to what happened. The premise is that after...
The premise actually, for anybody who's ever seen the movie Event Horizon, is similar in premise. However, it is very different in theme. Yeah. This isn't a horror story. This isn't like a grotesque Clive Barker kind of thing. But the overall idea is kind of the same. And I'll try to give a quick synopsis, no spoilers, is space shuttle goes up, space shuttle disappears, space shuttle comes back 10 years later, appearing different but not different.
So the shuttle venture, and actually if you read the foreword to this, you can see just how much this material, how much the idea of space travel and exploration mean to Warren Ellis. And yeah, that was one of the I actually read that first and was made me go, okay, I really do want to read the rest of this book. And yeah, wanted a chance when I could sit down and really read through it, knowing how much this material meant to him, that when you have that much emotion put into a book, it usually comes through. And I think it showed through in the material so well.
Definitely.
So after the shuttle venture disappeared, manned space travel stopped. And for the most part, the U.S. has led the way in manned space travel. There really has been very little outside of the U.S. Now with the space station, there's a bit more. But in the book, it stops completely. There is none. So now 10 years later, all of a sudden, the shuttle returns to Earth and it gives these three characters, one of whom is a biologist, one is a psychiatrist, yes, and the other is a engineer. Basically, he's a rocket scientist.
Yeah.
Who, when the shuttle program was decommissioned, when space exploration died, they lost their dreams. The biologist wanted to study what happens in space to the human body, what things do we are out there, what other life forms are out there. Mm-hmm. The rocket scientist, of course, wants to build bigger, better, faster engines and rockets and shuttles that are powered by them.
Mm-hmm.
And the psychologist is interested in what goes through people's minds, what experiences do they have.
Actually, she specifically says that being a psychiatrist, psychiatrist or psychologist? I'm not really sure. I never said that she can write a prescription. So anyways, what she specifically says, though, is that because of her profession, she was never going to go up. She was never going to go into space. But instead, she was able to do the interviews afterwards and be able to live their experience through their explanations of their experience.
So when the shuttle returns, they're able to start living their dreams again. It's this story. This story is about exploration.
Yeah.
And as they're going through,
there is
a hint of necessity, or that there's so much out there that we're missing out on. And, you know, part of this is, you know, it's also a bit of a detective story as these three individuals lead teams to try and discover what happened to the shuttle in the 10 years that it was gone. And the one surviving crew member that's back, what can he tell them? You know, how do they break him out of his comatose state? What happened?
Yeah, as a quick heads up for the answer to that question, weird shit.
Yeah. Actually,
weird. This is an Ellis story. This is Warren Ellis, so weird shit is basically going to be normal.
And if you happen to be a fan of technobabble, you will love this. There's plenty of technobabble in here.
Oh, God, yeah.
But there's a quote in here that I think summed this up so well for me. And the quote is, "I don't think you're thinking weird enough."
Yeah,
that's what's going on here, because what happened to the shuttle, the story, and that's what it's about. It's about our discovery and these characters' discovery of the shuttle, as much as it is of our need to take a shuttle out into space and to discover what's out there.
The reignition of the passion that died with the dying of the program. And this is also particularly poignant, especially now. Within the past month, 2 months, we've seen the cessation of the actual shuttle program. It is now done. It's over. No more shuttles are going to go up.
Right.
And within the past few years, we've seen the rise of the privatization of potential space travel, space travel. So this book was written, or at least the foreword of it, was written in 2003. The book's actually probably written, I think, prior to that.
Okay.
So you have this almost prophetic type of story.
What will happen when we no longer have the space travel that we finally ended?
Hey, if ending the space shuttle program means we get kooky, weird crap like that, I'm all about it.
Now, the other interesting thing, which I just really came to my mind, is brought up with what they see out there in space, what we run into as aliens, and that they're waiting on us. They're saying, we need you to take that next step so that we can come and say hello. It reminds me directly of Star Trek First Contact, Star Trek Next Generation First Contact, the movie.
Yeah, okay.
Because the Vulcans were waiting. As soon as we hit warp drive, they said they've reached that point that we can now say hello. We can reveal that there are other things out here. And that's what this book is saying, is that if we don't go out and explore,
they're going to get tired of waiting.
Yeah, they're not. Yeah, that's what they were doing. They were waiting for us. They were right there, you know, 10 years ago when the shuttle disappeared, waiting for us. And
basically,
we never took that next step. We were so close.
So scared, which is a recurring point in the book, is this idea of fear.
Right.
And the fear of taking the next step, the fear of making that leap into what should be almost our manifest destiny. And I hesitate to use that because of its historical significance.
Actually, I was listening to Star Talk, and they actually had a quote on there that what you just said is, you know, if God had intended us to explore space, he would have given us a moon.
So, okay. What was it? Tyson say that?
Tyson was quoting somebody else, but I think it's like a phrase in this – in the general realm of people that deal with space and space exploration.
Mm-hmm.
He was the one that actually said it during the show.
Yeah.
So, but that whole idea of, you know, the moon, it's a great place to start a landing base. You know, will we be able to get to Mars? They were talking, you know, it'll be 2035, 2040, and we will be able to get to Mars, and we'll get there eventually.
Yeah.
But, you know, how much are we going to be able to learn? There's only so much we can do with rovers and probes and unmanned missions. We've got to be able to send stuff up. You know, Tyson wants to send people to comets and meteors to connect, to comets, not to meteors, because meteors are falling there. Yeah, so got to be common.
Oh, no. Meteors aren't. Meteorites.
Meteorites have landed.
Other meteorites are still.
It's not a meteorite until it lands. So
I thought it was a meteorite when it actually enters atmosphere.
Yeah. I think it's a meteor once it enters atmosphere. Meteorite once. And we're talking semantics on things we don't fully understand right here.
But hello, Geek Netcast.
Yeah, it's Geek Chic. But
no, it's just geek. There's not very much chic about this.
I don't know. I think it's pretty silent.
So. You have just embarrassed every person that listens to this.
Oh, shut up.
Just saying.
All right, so. But the point being, you know, there's a lot out there in space, and this book kind of sums up some of those great feelings of exploring. You know, what would this country have been if we didn't have, you know, all the European explorers, Vasco da Gama, Cortez, coming out here and searching for different things, whether it's the Fountain of Youth, you know, Balboa finding the Pacific. You know, there's so much that's out there to explore. And those are government-funded missions. That's the thing.
Yeah.
All the major exploration that's found stuff has been government-funded, and we're missing out on that.
And all the government funding is slowly drying up in the face of economic issues.
Yes.
That the economy is what's preventing the government from doing the necessary stuff.
All right, let's get off the depressing sides of that stuff.
I'm moving on to that. getting back into comics, if you do read this, and you do in fact enjoy Warren Ellis has a very, very large library.
And real quick, because there's one books. Thing, because one of the things he's known for is swearing throughout his books.
Yeah,
and I know he doesn't do it as much in his traditional comics because he's written some Marvel stuff.
Oh yeah,
but this, but and in that he stays away from this.
In his action, own stuff, it's
there is one or two lines the beginning, the scene at what's happened to Kennedy Space Center, where it's just a vagrant village. That's very much his style. And there is one line in the middle of it where somebody just gets shocked and has a line that's very much Ellis. But for the most part, this is as you would expect these characters to be,
you know,
and is not an over-the-top characterization of the swearing.
Yeah.
Well, and actually, even the line actually fits in there. It's just you go, oh, yeah, that's standard
that, that's Ellis.
Yeah.
Well, and Ellis, it's not so much that he's profane or that he cusses a lot. He has some of the most unique cussing and swearing out of any artist that I've ever seen. He is a wordsmith when it comes to his not exposition, expletives.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, he has fun with his words.
Yes.
Yeah.
As an example, some good things to pick up that are from Warren Ellis. If you did enjoy this and want some further reading, look into the number one A top of his list, Transmetropolitan, which Filthy Language awaits you. By all means, if you pick up that
filthy
title.
Filthy language, drug use, boring.
You've been warned. If you want something that's more in the traditional comic style, go and find the old The Authority comics from when Wildstorm first came into existence. Very good stories, very good books, very much Ellis. Planetary is another series. A little heavy on the violence and on the swearing, but also very much more surrealist in a way, because it deals with the sort of like fringe of reality kind of things. And lastly, and this is the reason I brought these up in the first place, Ellis has also done and completed an online comic book called Freak Angels. That is a very, very good series. It's gotten lots of acclaim. It ran for, I believe, about 3 years, coming out a week at a time with 6 pages per week. So it's a significant amount of work.
Yeah. The whole thing's available online. You can find it at freakangels.com.
Yep.
So you don't have to buy it, but it is available.
It is available in print as trades, a total of 6 books. So it's definitely worth picking up. I'm actually going to talk a little bit later this week about webcomics in general. I'll touch on Freak Angels as well because it's the one that's most recent in my head. But I'll also go into comic strips online, individual comics along the lines of like Family Circle from traditional print, but the single panel comic, XKCD, like you mentioned earlier.
Which isn't a single panel many times.
Yeah. And the online comic books that Freak Angels falls into, as do a bunch of others that are worth mentioning. I'll talk about these later on in the week. Keep an eye on your RSS feed. I'll go ahead and put it out for you guys, and we can talk. You can listen to me at least blather on about it. there. Yay! So, be sure to check that out, like I said, a little later this week. We had some interesting news things come out this week that I know we mentioned at the top of the show we wanted to hit up. Let's start with this one, actually. The Ender's Game movie.
Okay. Which, again, deals with space travel and, you know, although, actually the book itself doesn't, but it does have a space travel, space element as well as, if you read the books, there's some special relativity theory going on in there. It's, you know, how you age during space travel. The basic premise of Ender's Game is Ender is a child prodigy who is brought to a school to train him to become the next general of the American armies. He's brought to a school. The entire school is there to train these children so that they will be prepared for the next time the buggers, which are an alien race that resemble bugs, hence their nickname buggers. When the buggers come to attack, they will have an entire trained command unit of these children that have grown up training to fight the aliens.
Literally, it is called Battle School,
yeah,
isn't it?
It is, yeah. It is literally called Battle School. Ender turns out to be the star pupil of the school. And there are battle games that they're going out, that they're, you know, training in, you know, different, you know. So they've recently announced, you know, they've been working on it for a long time. They've recently had some casting announcements for this movie. Mm-hmm. And the big one being Harrison Ford as, you know, Hiram Graff, who's the person in charge of the school.
This isn't the first time that the studios have taken a crack at Ender's Game. The property itself has come around, I think, a few times. But this is the first time it's really had any wheels underneath it, I think, right?
Yeah, this is the first time we're really hearing casting rumors or anything of that sort. And it makes me excited because I've loved this book. I've loved the entire series that's come, actually two series that came out of this book. Mm-hmm. And if they do the book right, it'll actually be nice because they'll actually have two series that they can spin off of this. The first series actually follows Ender himself after Battle School as... which is detailed in the book Ender in Exile, mm-hmm. and then later in the book Speaker for the Dead, which is actually came out as the second book in the Ender series.
Quick plug out here, author of all of these is Orson Scott Card, a very well-known and prolific sci-fi writer. So you can find all these local bookshop. Actually, you probably find them in your school library, really, because they're...
At least Ender's Game.
They're not infrequently used in curricula.
Yeah, Ender's Game has been a summer reading book for middle and high school students, and it is winner of both the Hugo and the Nebula Award, as was Speaker for the Dead, mm-hmm. and Children of the Mind, which is the sequel to that. No, sorry, Xenocide was the sequel to that. That was nominated for both, and then the last of the Ender series was Children of the Mind. Now, the other series that came out of this is... the Bean books, which Bean is another character from Ender's Game. He's becomes
second
Ender's
in command.
He becomes Ender's second in command, mm-hmm. as the experiences grow on. And while Ender is never allowed to return to Earth at the end of the game, Bean does. And Bean, the first Bean book is Ender's Shadow and actually tells Bean's experience shadowing Ender, being the one underneath Ender's shadow, always being behind him. The second book in the Bean series is Shadow of the Hegemon, which Ender's brother Peter, who was actually turned down for Battle School, has dreams of becoming the first world leader, controlling the entire globe under his one government. And Bean is working underneath him, behind the scenes, to actually accomplish this.
Well, you know, as far as we already have gotten, let's not get too much into the side stories because really, if those are going to make their way into movies, the first thing that needs to happen is Ender's Game has to come out, has to hit big, has to sell well, and has to be enough to make them actually want to continue with the series, which, as you're obviously saying, would be very, very good. I think there'd be a strong fan base for it. There have been enough people that have really read these books and know these books to appreciate a film version for this entire and not insignificant series.
Yes. And Bean has another three books after those two, if I remember correctly. I believe there's five in the Bean series. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of canon out there for them to work from. But they have to make the movie. Yeah, Bean has to be a character in the movie. and significant enough that you'll recognize him if they spin off, you know, I would guess they would spin off Shadow of the Hegemon. I don't think they would make a Bean movie from his point of view. That would be rather redundant from the Ender book.
Because the Ender Shadow really is the same as Ender's Game, just from Bean's point of view, right?
Yeah. And again, being a different character, he has different experiences at Battle School, but for the most part, the story is there.
It's the same chronology.
Same chronology. So you would take it, you know, from Shadow of the Hegemon and could spin off there. And with Ender, you could pick it up from Ender in Exile and follow that story arc. You know, we were talking about there is actually a video game that Ender plays when he's relaxing, not doing the battle drills. And that's an important thing that they'll have to include if they want to continue moving forward with Ender's side of the story. And who knows, they may just decide to move forward with Bean's and not Ender's side of the story. But as a studio, I can see them wanting to do both because, well, let's face it, two movies makes more, makes more money than one movie.
I can see them going a sort of Harry Potter route on this too, where you have the child actors that are brought in at the beginning and having that sort of like life cycle of them as actors and in the characters. So as the characters age, the actors age, and you get that consistent continuity with them going along as well, which would be smart if they do manage to do that, if they do happen to find some actors that have the chops and have the longevity to be able to pull that off, would be phenomenal.
Right.
But if.
Lots of ifs.
And this is true for any movie that's ever tried to be made. Yeah. It is very difficult to make a movie. It is very difficult to get a movie from conception to screen. Which is surprising considering a lot of shite that is out there.
Well, that's the thing. When you realize just how hard it is to, A, get a movie, you know, recognized as, oh, let's make this. Mm-hmm. And then all the stuff they have to go through to take that and turn it into a movie, you know, with rewrites, notes from the studio, notes. Yeah,
it's very, very easy for a movie to fail.
Yeah. And it's surprising that there's ever any good movies made. Because nobody goes out there, at least maybe everybody but Uwe Boll goes out there to make... nobody goes out there to make a bad movie. Nobody goes, let's see how bad we can make this bomb.
No, wait, who's the Plan 9 guy? Not Ed Harris.
Ed Wood.
Ed Wood, yeah.
Now, Ed Wood actually had a love for his movies and wanted them to be good.
He just sucked at it.
He just didn't know how.
Okay.
Uwe Boll, I'm not so sure. Well, I think he's just like, I can make more money. Let's throw some shit together.
Yeah. Now, speaking of things that could go down in a steaming pile of flames, Sci-Fi Network has discussed the possibility of creating a show based on Booster Gold. Now, I have a very strong suspicion that many of you listening right now are going, Booster who? Exactly. Booster Gold is a B-list character from the DC Universe who has had a couple of moments in the spotlight. Most notably, I think, during the Justice League Unlimited animated series on Cartoon Network, there was actually one or two episodes that featured Booster in the main role as a B-lister in the Justice League. So it really kind of works out well that he was this... Well, background character.
He's actually had a big push throughout the last couple of years. When DC did 52, he was one of the featured characters in that. And recently they had the Justice League...
International.
Yes. What was it? International as the... Well,
it started
the new
as...
title is International. I think it was Unlimited.
No, it started as the Generation Lost.
Justice League Generation Lost.
Which was that. That was the spinoff and from he was Blackest Night and led into Brightest Day.
Yeah. So he was featured prominently and there as a lead character. So he's had a lot of a push recently.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, as a solo character, this could actually work. Yeah, it'll be interesting to see because the whole premise of Booster Gold, since many of you are probably going, who? Booster Gold is actually from the future. In the future, he stole a suit of armor and other technology that allows him to have superpowers, traveled back in time, where he figured he could use his robot sidekick to tell him when and where crimes were because it has a database of the past. Thus, he could show up, use his superpowers to defeat the criminals, and become everybody's favorite superhero.
And marketable.
Yes. And then he could sell advertisements on his uniform like a NASCAR driver.
Yeah.
So the premise is there. This could be very fun. It could be, you know, it could get hokey. That's what they risk is drawing that line between a guy who can laugh at himself and still try and be a superhero and fail at it. Yeah, and
I think for the show to succeed, it's going to have to be a very, very good character study. It's going to have to be in his head a lot. It's going to have to be in his motivations a lot. It's going to have to basically be, for lack of a better way to put it, up his ass. I mean, you're really going to have to know this character inside and out for it to succeed, because you're going to need to be able to sympathize with him. You're going to need to be able to sympathize against him. And you're going to need to be able to really, really get in his shoes. Because if you're not able to do that and you're looking at him from the outside, then you'll end up being like the other characters that have dealt with him in the DCU historically, where they've just looked at him as a schmuck.
Yeah, which actually, the fact that other DC characters look at him as a schmuck actually leads to another interesting point that they could do with this character, which is the fact that he's actually become the guardian of the timeline. You know, in DC Comics, you can travel back and forth in time. His job is to make sure you don't screw things up.
Yeah.
As part of doing that, he has to hang out with the mass of superheroes that are currently prevalent in the DC universe. And doing so, he has to act like a buffoon, because that's what he first showed up as before he became the guardian of time. So they could actually bring that in. I don't know how well...
He has to be almost like the unsung hero. Like, he has to be the shadow worker, because that's the only way he can get his job done.
Well, that leads to another question. Is he going to be the solo hero in the series, or is he going to have other heroes around him? Will he be working with Superman or Batman?
Mm-hmm.
You know, are there going to be, you know, other members of the Justice League International or Justice League America that will appear in the show? I think it might be interesting to see him solo, in which case, you know, it makes it a little bit harder. It makes it easier in that you don't have to bring in other characters. You don't have to show, you can actually show him as a hero. He doesn't have to be that goof off, but then you can have the side job of him actually protecting the time stream. Being that it's Sci-Fi Network that's talking about airing this show, dealing with time stream, you know,
it's their boathouse. I mean, it's what they're good at.
You would have to have him just as a straight superhero if this was to air on standard network TV or even USA. But Sci-Fi, you can really bring in that whole element of protector of the timeline, yeah, and play with the Doctor Who-esque, you know, feel of him on that end. Yeah. So.
No, sorry, I just had a thought of them putting the show on FX and having them actually like punch people's heads off their shoulders.
So, it could be a very interesting thing. I actually like Booster Gold, and if this comes out, I would like to see it.
I like the modern version of Booster Gold. I actually had, and I'm kicking myself for it now, I had Booster Gold number one. I actually had his first comic from way back when. I picked it up on the cheap at a local comic shop over in Daytona Beach. And it's something I'm kicking myself for now, because I handed it off. And because he is getting the push now, I'm thinking, I'm a dumbass for getting rid of that.
Yeah, you are.
Yeah. But anyways.
And this could also be kind of fun. Even if they don't have other heroes, yeah, to have his best friend be Ted Kord would be really fun. Ted Kord was the original Blue Beetle. So, you know, to have him come in and, you know, have Ted Kord as a side character, even if he's not a hero, just as, like, the best friend character, would be a nice little thumbs up to, you know, all the fans that have been reading the comics, even if Ted Kord doesn't take on the character.
Honestly, I'd rather just flat out see a Blue Beetle show instead.
Yeah.
That's just me, though.
Ted Kord, Blue Beetle, or Reyes?
No, I think I'd prefer Reyes, actually. Kord would be okay, but I would prefer Reyes.
DC did have a live-action test screening of, just 5 minutes of footage of the Reyes Blue Beetle.
And him actually like getting attached to the Scarab in the first place.
Yeah.
Phenomenal screen test.
Yeah.
I mean, if you've never seen Blue Beetle, if you saw that scene, you'd probably either think you're watching a horror movie or just go, yeah, I want to see that.
So. But they haven't done anything that I've heard of with that as far as moving forward on that project, which is a shame.
Very much. I had a couple things I was going to hit on, but I'm going to snatch out a couple of these, and I'm just going to hit one in particular. And that's Scott McCloud on his Google Plus stream this week.
Okay.
Shared a online comic by Josh Neufeld called Bahrain lines in ink, lines in the sand. This online comic actually describes the experiences that Josh had in the country of Bahrain, which, if you don't know, it's off the coast of Saudi Arabia, just north of Oman in the actual Persian Gulf, in the Gulf itself. It has been a fairly liberal country as far as the Middle East is concerned. Lots of westernization, McDonald's and other things like that in the country. They have a large Sunni and Shiite population, which, if you're familiar with Middle East politics, those are the two big Muslim factions.
That are warring.
Very frequently. But in Bahrain, there was really this kind of mutual respect within the country that they kept a balance, and it was okay. There was, I believe, I'm trying my hardest to make sure I get this right, that the Sunnis felt that they were largely being unrepresented by the Shiite minority, which is interesting because the Shiite were the minority in the country, but yet they were the country's leaders. And so the Sunni, being the simple majority of people, were not getting the representation that they wanted. During or in this year, we've seen what they're calling the Arab Spring, where there's been lots of revolution and right. overturning in the Middle East. It affected Bahrain as well for a very short period of time. I believe they actually called it the Pearl Revolution because Bahrain makes most of its money, or traditionally made most of its money, through pearl farming off of its coasts until they recently discovered oil in Bahrain. When that happened, the game sort of changed. So with that background, the author and artist, Josh Neufeld, went to Bahrain, met actually two individual comic book or comic artists in the country, and when he returned home, both of them friended him on Facebook. And this is before the Arab Spring started. Since then, and during the revolutions, what happened was each of those individual artists actually took opposing sides in this conflict. And while he was still friends with both of them, he was able to get this input on both of their point of views at the same time occurring within the country, while at the same time they were putting out their own political cartoons explaining the situation as they saw it. And so this book, which it's very short, it's only like about 18 page total, includes those political cartoons in, along with his illustrations and his story of his experience of working with the two of them, and also his experiences from them after the fact. I think he tries to keep it as politically neutral as possible, although I do think he does seem to show a leaning towards one of them more so than the other. That was my personal point of view. At least I think he seemed that way. This story reminds me very, very much of Persepolis, which we reviewed
yes.
just a couple weeks ago, in that it is, one, it's from the Middle East point of view, obviously, but more so, it's very good about giving you that insider viewpoint that a lot of times that we in the West just flat out don't seek out.
This is what the person on the ground is actually feeling and experiencing. And it's actually two people on the ground that are seeing and experiencing two different things
yeah.
because they have opposing points of view.
And it also gives you the bigger picture that you might not see otherwise. That while Bahrain does have this internal struggle and their own fights of what's going on, at the same time they have this giant of Iran looming over them that they feel could very – because – Iran has always said that they felt Bahrain was sort of their 14th province. Like, they felt that Bahrain always should have been a part of Iran as well. So they have that, you know, big specter looming over their head at the same time while all this stuff is going on. And they know and they're aware that their own internal civil conflict is weakening them against what could be even greater external threats. So, and that in itself is even part of the conflict, in that one side is basically saying, no, leave things alone. Don't start shaking crap up, because if you do, all you're doing is making us weaker to those outside of us, while the other side is saying, oh, well, you're just saying that because you're currently in power. Of course you want to keep things the way it is. You don't want to have a revolution.
Right.
So this is it's a very, very good read. It's a very interesting story to just go and check through really quick. find Scott McCloud on Google Plus. It's very easy to find from there. Otherwise, try doing a search for Josh Neufeld and from that, see if you can find this comic. Like I said, short read, pick it up. Even if you're not necessarily very interested in Middle East politics, it's worth reading.
I think anytime you can get, especially if you got two factions, when you get both sides of it, you can read that because it may inform you about the world that you live in and maybe help you to see something that in our daily lives that we don't see the other side of. You know, mm-hmm. It may make you go, maybe that's why this person at work sees or says or says or does something, because the experiences are transcendent to just the specific instance mm-hmm. that they're portrayed at.
And the other thing to be careful of too is that make sure if you are trying to get that dual viewpoint, that you are in fact getting a dual viewpoint and not a single viewpoint that's explaining theirs and the enemy's, which a lot of times you'll get things that are purported to be, the fair and balanced type of story when it's...
And they weaken the opposing argument to specifically be destroyed by their arguments.
Exactly.
Or they'll leave out elements that they can't refute.
Mm-hmm.
So, okay.
Wow, that soapbox is a lot taller than I thought it would be.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a long way down.
Okay. Anyways, there were a couple other things I was going to hit on, but you know what? I think we can hold these off.
Yeah, they'll hold.
Yeah.
We've got another show coming up after we get comics on Wednesday, so.
That's true. And we'll probably have another big stack this week now that DC will be shoving more things down our throat that we will accept happily and with smiles on our faces.
Yeah, but it's more comics, and that's the important thing is we get to read more. So
we're such whores.
Yes, well, give me my comics and shut up.
On that note, let's go ahead and sign off.
All right.
Well, we will as soon as my moronic self actually manages to get all the stuff that we actually need to sign off.
Well, then go ahead and check out the website. That's thecomicbooknerd.com. You can also find us on Twitter, @acomicbooknerd, @FelixTCat, that's cat with K and two T's, and @JPolyF. You can send us an email at comicbooktesseract@gmail.com, or you can send us a voicemail or a text message at 50Tesseract. That's 508-377-3722.
I'm sorely tempted to have just a total Wayne's World kind of exit here.
Which the false ending?
Not the false ending. Just the full jam out rocking. Party time! Excellent. Yeah. We probably shouldn't do that though, should we?